Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, Baruch Spinoza, narrated by Charlton Heston, Part 7.
As Spinoza sees it, God cannot work miracles in the interests of mankind. He believes that God can't break the laws of his own nature so that a virgin can give birth to a divine son who will grow up to suffer for our sins. Nor has God written ethical rules on tablets of stone to guide mankind. According to Spinoza, all such stories come from the confusions of the imagination. Man's special status resides entirely in his exceptional ability to understand. If we're to experience salvation or live ethically, it must be by means of that understanding. But just what could the terms salvation and ethics mean to Spinoza? If there is no anthropomorphic divine judge who threatens eternal damnation for misconduct, what need is there for salvation? And if all human actions are the necessary effects of natural causes, what could be the point of an ethical code of conduct? These are questions a number of Spinoza's friends asked him in his own day. They were worried that his views might undermine religion by denying the existence of heaven and hell, might weaken law and morality by allowing criminals and sinners to claim that their deeds were the result of inevitable causal necessity. One friend wrote about his concerns in a letter.
If we men are, in all our actions, under the power of God, like clay in the hands of the potter, how can any of us be accused of doing this or that, seeing that it was impossible for him to do otherwise? Everyone may plead, "Thy power cannot be escaped from, O God. Therefore, since I could not act otherwise, I may justly be excused."
This is an old, deeply important issue. Theology attempts to reconcile God's omnipotence with our moral responsibility. Scientifically minded people try to reconcile the idea of moral responsibility with the deterministic view that every event, including every human action, is caused by prior events based on natural law. For Spinoza, of course, these are two versions of the same problem, because he identifies God with nature and God's will with the laws of nature. His answer to this question helps explain his whole approach to ethics. Spinoza agrees that in one sense, the perpetrator of evil acts can be excused, since the actions were inevitable in the course of nature. But he still believes a man may be rightly imprisoned or executed for breaking the law. Such legal sanctions are a natural consequence of society's efforts to protect itself from harm. But in addition to the punishment society visits on a wrongdoer, Spinoza argues that evil and vicious actions bring their own bad consequences for the person who performs them. He who acts greedily, hatefully, violently, or selfishly will be an unhappy man, for unhappiness follows naturally and inevitably from such actions. The venal man who acts in this way will have no chance for blessedness. Such people will be miserable not because God will punish them, but because misery is the natural consequence of vicious actions and attitudes. Indeed, Spinoza submits a view of human emotions to demonstrate that this is the case. You could say, then, God punishes evildoers, but only in the sense that the laws of nature dictate that misery follows naturally upon doing and being evil. Spinoza is not interested in threatening people with divine punishment. He's interested in understanding human nature, human happiness. As he sees it, that's the point of studying ethics. Spinoza's understanding of ethics goes back to the ancients. The roots of his approach are to be found in Socrates, in Aristotle, in the Stoics, and in Lucretius. According to these ancient philosophers, the purpose of an ethical theory is to provide guidance in living a good life. The good life is simply the happy life, a life of joy and security, a life without pain, conflict, tension, or strife. These early authors were familiar, as all people are, with the pain of negative emotions like fear, hatred, envy, sadness, and anger. They saw people chasing impossible dreams and living lives of quiet, or not so quiet, desperation, when their unrealistic dreams failed to materialize. These philosophers saw how the lack of self-control can lead to disaster and suffering. Fear, hatred, excessive ambition, impulsive actions, these they called unruly passions, and they sought to overcome them. The whole purpose of an ethical theory, as they saw it, is to explain the sources of happiness and of misery in human life, and to offer a plan for attaining the happiness and avoiding the misery. Spinoza agrees with this concept of the purpose of ethics, indeed of philosophy as a whole. As we've seen, he began his philosophical journey in the effort to find supreme and unending happiness. Noting that happiness and unhappiness seemed to be emotions, he tried to understand what emotions are, how they arise. He found that some emotions are pleasurable, others are painful. Most importantly, he found that we can control some while others seem to have us in their control. Like the ancients, Spinoza believed that achieving happiness requires us to overcome those painful emotions that control us. In doing this, we not only become happier, we achieve a kind of freedom and security unknown to those with uncontrolled negative emotions. Spinoza's strategy for attaining happiness and freedom depends on understanding emotions. In one of the most impressive of his achievements as a thinker, Spinoza presents a detailed and systematic theory of just what human emotions are, how they arise, how they can best be dealt with. As always, he proceeds in accordance with his geometrical method, basing his claims on what he's already proven regarding God, nature, and the human body and mind. In a striking passage, Spinoza distinguishes his approach from that of the preachers and other moralists.
Most of those who have written about the emotions and human conduct seem to be dealing not with natural phenomena that follow the common laws of nature, but with phenomena outside nature. They appear to go so far as to conceive man in nature as a kingdom within a kingdom. They believe that he disturbs rather than follows nature's order. They assign the cause of human frailty not to the power of nature in general, but to some defect in human nature, which they therefore bemoan, ridicule, despise, or, as is most frequently the case, abuse. They will doubtless find it surprising that I should attempt to treat of the faults and follies of mankind in the geometric manner, and that I should propose to bring logical reasoning to bear on what they claim is opposed to reason. But hatred, anger, envy, etc., follow from the same necessity and force of nature as do all other particular things. Thus, I shall consider human actions and appetites just as if it were an investigation into lines, planes, or solids.
Spinoza's theory of the emotions begins with the human body as a composite organism. The body is a complex mode of extension whose chief concern is to maintain itself. The body seeks things that will prolong its life, and in the mind, this becomes an idea called desire. As the body interacts with other things in nature, its power to preserve itself intact is sometimes naturally increased. For example, the body may experience an increase in energy. The mind registers this increase in the body's energy as the emotional idea we call joy or pleasure. On the other hand, the body is sometimes naturally affected by other things that decrease its power for self-preservation. The mind's idea of the body's decrease in energy is called sadness or pain. Spinoza will use these three most basic emotions, desire, joy, and sadness, to develop a remarkably subtle and thorough account of human psychology. Before tracing that development, though, let's note an important point about the foundations of his theory. He emphasizes that the body naturally tends to seek things that increase its ability to survive and to avoid things that threaten it. The mind reflects these bodily activities, but the mind does not cause them. A basic tenet of Spinoza's view is that events in the body must be understood by referring to other physical things. In part, this is Spinoza's answer to the difficulties of Descartes' ghost in the machine view. Since we can't understand how the mind can cause the body to do things, we must explain the body's behavior in purely physical terms. In taking this stand, Spinoza's anticipating modern attempts to explain behavior by studying the physical structure and function of the body and the brain. This was a very radical view in the 17th century, for common sense seems to tell us that the mind causes the body to act. Spinoza knows his viewpoint will encounter resistance.
Men can hardly be induced to examine this view without prejudice. So strongly are they convinced that at the mere bidding of the mind, the body can now be set in motion, now brought to rest, and can perform any number of actions which they think depend solely on the will of the mind. However, no one as yet has learned what the body can and cannot do without being determined by the mind, solely from the laws of its nature, insofar as it is considered physical.
Spinoza seeks to explain emotion based on the body's interaction with things around it. For example, when something causes us joy, that is, when something or someone causes an increase in our power to preserve ourselves, then we experience love towards that thing or that someone.
From this, we can clearly understand what love and hate are. Love is nothing but joy, with the accompanying idea of an external cause. And hate is nothing but sadness, with the accompanying idea of an external cause. One who loves necessarily strives to have present and preserve the thing he loves. And on the other hand, he who hates strives to remove and destroy the thing he hates.
The way these emotions arise explains why we love or hate things that have not directly affected us, but which may resemble things that have caused us pleasure or pain.
From the mere fact that we imagine a thing to have some likeness to an object that usually affects the mind with joy or sadness, we love it or hate it.
These stray loves and hatreds arising from chance similarities can lead to vacillation and conflicting emotions.
If we imagine that a thing which usually affects us with an emotion of sadness is like another which usually affects us with an equally great emotion of joy, we shall hate it and at the same time love it.
Since we want to preserve the things and people we love because they cause us joy, we will develop loves and hatreds towards other things which hurt or help these objects of love.
If we imagine someone to affect with joy a thing we love, we shall be affected with love toward him. If, on the other hand, we imagine him to affect the same thing with sadness, we shall also be affected with hate toward him.
There are endless ways in which emotions can arise toward other things and people, and Spinoza explores these ways at great length. He spins out the consequences of his theory in detail, deducing the nature and causes of diverse emotions such as pity, envy, lust, greed, humility, and pride. All of these are explained to be natural consequences of the basic emotions of desire, joy, and sadness. All of them have their foundation in the body's natural endeavor to survive as a stable organism in a varied environment. But it's obvious that, so far, the individual's emotional life is very unstable, and the desires arising from these emotions are very unreliable. We come to love things that do not truly benefit us, merely because they superficially resemble things that do. We vacillate between love and hatred of things. As Spinoza puts it,
we are driven about in many ways by external causes, and like waves on the sea driven by contrary winds, we toss about, not knowing our outcome and fate.
A permanently happy human life requires more stability than this. We need a way to navigate these stormy seas, and if possible, to calm the raging winds. But it does no good just to complain about the erratic and inconstant nature of human beings. Spinoza's demonstrated that these inconstancies arise inevitably from the very laws of nature, coupled with man's status as finite being in the midst of nature. Simply telling people there's a better way is useless. The mind cannot, simply by having good ideas, determine our emotions. As Spinoza sees it, our confused and inconstant emotions can be countered only by other emotions. Stronger and more stable emotions are needed to impose order and direction on wayward passions. He says,
an emotion can only be controlled or destroyed by another emotion contrary thereto, and with more power for controlling emotion.
Every individual is motivated by the desire to survive, so an ethical program will be accepted only if it appeals directly to each person's self-interest. Spinoza is a clear-headed egoist in this regard. The only motives anyone has are self-interested motives. It makes no sense to recommend an ethical doctrine on any other grounds. If people are to be virtuous, it can only be because virtue is in each individual's self-interest. Traditionally, moralists have thought that there's some God-given standard of what is good and what is bad, and that we have a duty to live up to that standard by always choosing what is good. Spinoza, not surprisingly, thinks that this view is confused. He believes the traditional moralists have put the cart before the horse. According to him, we do not choose things because we judge them to be good. Rather, we judge things to be good because we want them.
It is clear that we neither strive for, nor will, neither want nor desire anything because we judge it to be good. On the contrary, we judge something to be good because we strive for it, will it, want it, or desire it. And so each one, from his own emotions, judges a thing good or bad.
In fact, Spinoza holds that the words good and evil do not refer to any objective characteristic of things in themselves at all.
As far as good and evil are concerned, they indicate nothing positive in things considered in themselves, nor are they anything other than modes of thinking or notions that we form because we compare things to one another. For one and the same thing can, at the same time, be good and bad, and also indifferent. For example, music is good for one who is melancholy, bad for one who is mourning, and neither good nor bad to one who is deaf.
The traditional moralists had tried to establish a definition of goodness that's independent of people's actual makeup and desires. Spinoza says this was bound to fail. We can be certain of at least one thing. Everyone wants to increase his power to survive. The only appropriate way to use the term good, then, is to refer to those things that will truly make us stronger and help us survive. This is the true good that Spinoza seeks to explain. He thinks it's obvious that people have an interest in controlling their own emotions rather than having their emotions control them. All the confused and conflicting emotions we've discussed so far arise from chance encounters with things in the external world. Spinoza says humans have little control over emotions stimulated from without. These are passive emotions. There are some emotions, though, that can arise from within us. They may arise from our own powers, and they therefore may be regarded as active emotions. To the extent that these active emotions can predominate in someone's psychological life, he is more in control, and less hostage to the raging seas of passion and the changing winds of fortune. When we discussed Spinoza's doctrine of knowledge, we noted that the higher kinds of knowledge, reason and intuition, proceed from ideas of the laws of nature. These laws are ideas that are adequate in the mind. We reason about things in an order provided by the ideas in our minds rather than imaginatively perceiving things in whatever order they happen to come in contact with our bodies. In this sense, we're more active when reasoning than when imagining, because the order of ideas arises from within our minds. The very increase in activity produced by rational thought is experienced as joy, since it reflects an increase in our own active power. Moreover, since our thoughts are determined from within, when we're reasoning, we're more self-determining, more free. Thus, the active emotion of joy, engendered by reason and understanding, provides a means to counteract the inconstant and erratic impulses of the passions. Spinoza's strategy in presenting his ethical theory is to sketch a life that maximizes the active emotions, emotions that arise from understanding. By examining that life, we can determine how a genuinely stable, free person would act. Then we can use these insights as guidelines for developing strength and freedom for ourselves.
This is the end of Part 7. Please download Part 8 to continue.